This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. This week is WVXU and WMUB's Winter Fund Drive. If you've never given before, take that first step now by becoming a member. Individual contributions from listeners like you keep the news and information you depend on every day on the air. You can give online at WVXU.org or WMUB.org or by calling 513-419-7155. In the January issue of Cincinnati Magazine, dining editor Joanne Drilling has a fascinating article about members of the Ruffed Grouse Society. True conservationists, these bird hunters have a special connection with and respect for the outdoors, but many fear they're a dwindling breed. And joining us to take a closer look at the world of bird hunting are Joanne Drilling and members of the local chapter of the Ruffed Grouse Society, Mark Jones, outdoor writer and author Ron Ellis, and wildlife artist John Ruthven. Good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon, Mark.
Good afternoon.
And you can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Joanne, I have to know, how did you, as the dining editor for Cincinnati Magazine, end up doing an article about hunting and conservation?
Well, initially it started out as an idea to maybe write something about game birds as, you know, a sustainable source of local protein, something like that. My dad has always been a hunter, and I really grew up eating all different kinds of birds and venison and things like that. And so to me, that's really a normal part of, you know, what we ate. And so I kind of wanted to delve a little bit into something along those lines. And then very quickly, it became obvious that the story wasn't really about cooking at all. The story, you know, as I got to know Mark and John and Ron, the story was about the conservation efforts that the Ruffed Grouse Society is making.
So were you surprised by the shift in direction that the story took as you were writing it?
Maybe a little bit, but I do find that I really believe in the power of the story. You know, so I feel like sometimes when it's going off in a different direction, it's just worth
just
it
go
to
with
kind
the flow.
Go with the flow and go down that road and see where it leads you.
Mark, can you talk about that? What is the Ruffed Grouse Society?
Okay, it's an organization of people, ordinary people, that love a activity, up and game hunting, grouse and woodcock hunting, and they're giving back to the activity, the sport, conservation, preservation and creation of habitat and all the healthy forests.
What's the local chapter has a specific name, right?
It's the Gilbert Simons chapter, S-Y-M-O-S, M-O-N-S.
Okay, and tell me about Mr. Simons.
John probably knows Gilbert much better than I do,
okay.
But I've only known him 30 years.
I can't say I'm more than that, but certainly that much.
And he was the sportsman. He hunted and he fished, and he hunted with some of the iconic people in the 20th century around the world. You know, he'd fish Christmas Island in the Pacific and collect every year he'd go to Michigan and collect mushrooms, and he was always pulling out some tackle or gear that was, oh my God, how rare is that? And, you know, it's really just amazing thing, and he gave back. He was just a generous and wonderful guy.
Sounds
he
like
really
he
was. I remember going to his funeral. They had him all dressed up like a Scotsman in a wonderful tartan outfit, and over his shoulder he had his walking stick with a morel mushroom carved in the top of it, and that's the way he was laid out and buried as such. But he was a consummate outdoor person and loved every detail of it. He was a good friend of Carl Maslovsky. Do you remember Carl Maslovsky?
The bird photographer.
Yeah, and he wrote the outdoor columnist for the Cincinnati Enquirer for 25 years.
Yeah, that's right.
How many members do you have locally?
Well, we're not a very official group in terms of we have to fill out a form and belong a member. I think we mail 300 or 400 people, and then there's a group from 15 to 30 people that are very active.
Rhonda, can you tell us what is a ruffed grouse? Can you describe those birds to me?
The ruffed grouse?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, here in Ohio,
There's essentially two phases of this bird. North of us here, quite north of us, so they're in a gray phase, and here in Ohio, a reddish phase. What would you say, Mark? Pound and a half? 2 pounds at most?
Well, that's a very big one, I would guess.
That's a big one. I'd say a pound, a pound and a half. I think the last time I saw a count, someone estimated there might be like 3,000 feathers on one grouse that a biologist counted.
Wow.
They're an incredible bird, incredibly fast, challenging to hunt, and absolutely magnificent. And, you know, as far back as some of the great painters like Winslow Homer and certainly Audubon and our own John Ruffin, of course, and other many, many great artists and writers, Turgenev, Thoreau, even Hemingway and Faulkner, all of them, they and Rick Bass and Tom McGuane, Jim Harrison, they've all written and praised the bird as the king of the uplands. It's quite a magnificent bird that's inspired a lot of artwork, both on the page and on the canvas.
Now, these birds make a very unique sound called drumming, and this is what it sounds like. So, Ron, how are they doing that, and why are they doing that?
It's a ritual. Classically, I think they do it throughout the year, but they do it in the spring, classically, to attract attention for mating for females, and classically on a log that's called a drumming log. And they used to think that they hit their wings together, but as I recall now, the better thinking is that it's trapping air and creating that sound as they beat their wings faster and faster. This much I can tell you, when you're out and you hear it, at first you think it's almost like a tractor engine starting up. And you can feel it in your chest, the sound itself. But certainly John could describe that a lot better with all the study he's done on rough grouse.
Well, but there's, I think, the opposite side of the interesting story is when you're in the woods in the fall hunting grouse or hikers in the woods, and those same wings make that whoop, boop sound when they come up nearby, and you,
absolutely.
Oh, I better go check my underwear.
As many times as I've hunted grouse, I'm always ready for what's going to happen. But one takes off, I'm totally surprised and just shooken by the bird getting off, although I know it so well.
Johnson,
I don't think you ever get accustomed to that sound when they come up in front of you.
It's almost
for myself. I'm always a little behind when I shoot too, so it's a pretty amazing thing. Yes,
it's almost otherworldly to me when I hear it. It's like I've never heard that before. So it's fascinating. John, you're holding an event to talk about these. What is a woodcock?
Well, a woodcock is an upland game bird that's hunted just like a rough grouse. It's much smaller. But it has one major attribute that the rough grouse does not have. It has a beak almost as long as its body. It's not as near as big a bird as a rough grouse. And it has a very special mating ritual. At this time of year, it's just getting started. And the male, in his efforts to attract the female, will fly up, way up in the sky at dusk, and come wafting back down, making a whistling sound to attract her. And if he does it right, he's got his gal like that.
How did you first become fascinated with nature and the outdoors?
It's been a lifelong thing with me. As a little kid, I've always been an outdoor person. And in those days when I remember when I bought my first shotgun, I was 10 years old, and I bought it for $4 at a store up in Walnut Hills. Right now, they would hung me by my thumbs and probably put this other guy away for life who sold it to me. But I was geared to that, and I loved every aspect of it. But also, I always wanted to be a wildlife painter, never dreaming that I could ever achieve that.
Mark, how did your love of hunting and nature come about?
Well, with my father, and that was his sport. His main leisure activity was bird dogs and hunting. I grew up in Michigan, and that was training the dogs, getting them in shape, getting me in shape, and my father was always in shape, and training the dogs, getting them ready, and it was just a ritual, and you get excited, and there was that when you had to get your license, and you had to check the guns, and buy a box of shells, and I mean, it was, and that's, I can remember.
A ritual.
A ritual. And starting out, I was so small that you would carry a, man, like a pop gun, you know, shot a cork. And then after all the lectures and about gun safety, maybe you'd go to a BB gun. And then, you know, as you got older and older and became more responsible, you'd graduate to a real firearm. But at first, you could only, you carried it, and then if the dog pointed, my dad would hand me a shell, and you'd load it and just make sure you were safe. And I don't know, it's
sounds
the,
like it was
the smell. Yeah. And I know Ron's the, I call Ron the romantic, but the smell of the fall, and the smell of a fired shotgun, and the sounds, and
it's the mystique of the sport.
Yes.
Another thing,
you know,
my dad
gave me the gift too, and I think that's often the way it happens with the father or another mentor of some kind to introduce you to the sport, whether hunting or fishing and or just wandering, you know, hiking, canoeing. But my dad gave it to me in one little story about Mark, where he talked about his dad handing him the shell. Once when my father gave me my first gun, a 410, single shot, he let me carry the shells on a hunt one day. We were bird hunting this day, and we had been rabbit hunting. That was my dad's favorite, was rabbit and squirrels. And he said, now we're bird hunting. Don't take any shots at rabbits today. I said, no, sir, I won't. And he was a strict taskmaster on this, and this will illustrate just how strict. A rabbit jumped up. It was away from the dog and from my dad, and it was clearly a safe shot. I took it. I missed it. My father walks over to me and said, did you flush a quail? I said, no, sir, I shot at a rabbit. Well, he made me hand over, I think I had a dozen shells in my vest. He made me hand over all my shells and walk the rest of the day with an empty gun as the birds flushed up in front of the bird dog. So that was a lesson I never forgot. And I think that's how you come to this sport. Through your mentors and strict tutelage as to how it's to be done, and respect for the animals and the land. And grouse hunters are particularly fine at that.
Yeah. Another aspect I'd like to put in there is that I know when I was a little kid, my mother always said, if you shoot it, you eat it. And
absolutely.
So I remembered that.
Yes.
And so I've been collecting Epicurean remnants from all kinds of magazines on how to cook your grouse. Or how to cook your whatever it was.
And well, that's all part of the conservation mindset, though.
It
you,
is.
You don't waste
you
it.
Don't.
You use it, right?
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Speaking of conservation, though, what are some of the conservation projects that the Ruffed Grouse Society has been involved in?
Well, locally, at Indian Creek Wildlife Management area near Fayetteville, we've been cutting large timber, large trees for annually for about 10 years to create the scientific term's early successional forest. It's young brushy woods, and that's the kind of habitat that grouse or woodcock like. So we've been doing that about 10 years. We've had a number of projects in the Shawnee National Forest, the Wayne Forest, Tranquility Wildlife Management Area, to, you know, in the end to create good habitat for grouse and woodcock. And the beauty, my wife and I are bird watchers too, is those young brushy woods is where you find the yellow-breasted chat and the Carolina or the Kentucky warbler and all the neotropical birds that I know John's painted some of them there. I mean, which are just
a lot of them
spectacular in the springtime, and it's a win-win situation all around.
Joanne, did you go out hunting with them to do this story?
We did some dog training exercises, and we spent some time out in the field.
What was that like?
It was great. I mean, Mark has three dogs, and they're wonderful. I enjoyed spending time with the dogs, and Lois and Ron came along as well, and it was just great. I mean, to be outside, to tramp around in the woods, and our photographer from Cincinnati Magazine, Jonathan Willis, came along, and I know he really enjoyed it, too. We went out on one of the first really chilly fall mornings, and we had a great time.
Now, you had an interesting conversation with Mark Wiley from the Ohio Division of Wildlife that I found to be kind of surprising.
Right.
And I think, as you put it in the article, it's a counterintuitive thing, the idea of cutting down trees to help create habitats. So what is the idea behind that?
Well, the idea is that we're kind of in a popular thinking rut, I'm going to call it, that the best thing for the environment is to just let it go, to not touch anything and to just let things grow as they will. But in reality, the way things were before, we had basically, you know, we had a lot more disasters, whether they were fires or things that changed the face of nature. Whereas now, if something is in a protected area and nothing is ever done to it, if it's, you know, like a state forest or something like that, and, you know, we do all these things to make sure it never catches on fire or that the land is never cleared, it becomes what I think Mark called a monoculture. Is that right?
Yes.
And then it limits the amount of different kinds of species that can live in it, because it's supporting one kind of environment. And so with the early successional forest, which, you know, Mark explained pretty well in depth, and then he gave me some references from some things, some studies that other environmentalists and scientists had done. It shows that the early successional forest, so when we have some of the bigger trees taken away and we have a lot like a brushy, scrubby kind of area where there's a lot of, you know, kind of standing little bits of standing water and things like that, right? That it supports a much more diverse, I guess you would call it, strata of organisms, right?
And before the white man, fires, often the Indians set fires, natural fires, ice storms, wind storms, all those kind of things created that diversity of habitat. And today, with shopping centers and subdivisions and so on, we're losing habitat. And habitat, if it's stagnant in a public land area and it's not managed, it becomes all big trees or something that doesn't carry as many kinds of wild animals.
Ron, were hunters conservationists well before the ecology movement came along?
Was that to me, Mark?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Hunters before the ecology market, was that correct?
Yes, but hunters being, they were conservationists. Were they conservationists well before the ecology movement?
Oh, I think so, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, my father was... as John said before, you didn't take anything that you didn't expect to eat, never killed anything. And my father thought it was important to protect the land, to take good care and be responsible stewards of these places that we love to go to and to hunt. And he thought it was important, too, to know the plants and to know the animals and to be able to name them. It wasn't a sport to him, nor is it really a sport to me. It was a way of approaching your life, actually. And I think they predate that quite a bit, and Aldo Leopold, of course, is the father of the conservation movement, in my mind, from his book, A Sand County Almanac from 1949.
Yeah,
and he speaks of hunting grouse in there in a beautiful essay called Red Lanterns.
Teddy Roosevelt, you go
yeah,
back.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think, is it George Bird Grinnell? I think,
yes. That's
it. Is that the right
absolutely.
Name? Yes. And yes. Though... leaders like that in America is what game laws and
National Park
and those kind of things for that were hunters.
Right. And Leopold was a great hunter.
Yes.
I mean, he wrote often and well about both hunting feathered game quite often with grouse or partridges. He wrote about them and woodcock. And, he sang the praises and... He was a tremendous, tremendous tutor for an awful lot of people that had brought that conservation ethic forward.
John, what does it mean to be an ethical hunter? And everybody can weigh in on this one, because I think you all have the answer to this in mind.
Well, I think, first of all, an ethical hunter is a careful hunter, not only from the standpoint of himself, but his companions around him. And also... you watch where you shoot. You're out with three other fellows, and you don't try to be a game hog when the bird flies up, that you try to be as ethical as you possibly can. And then, of course, being very aware of the land you're hunting on, it is owned by someone, and you want to take as much care of that, going over fences properly, shutting fences, and not disturbing wildlife as much as possible. So I think there's a lot of ethics involved in it.
Mark, what does that mean to you, being an ethical hunter?
That killing is not the first object. That's not the primary focus. It's
absolutely
the land, the habitat, the animal, and the relationship to man, and how all those things work together, and being you respect all that. And I guess, and I know Ron is this way, that training dogs, working with the dogs, seeing the dogs work, and being out in the fall is much more important than, you know, the actual
Killing of a bird.
Killing of a bird.
My dad always said that, you know, hunting was, I can hear him saying it, is less than 0.1% is pulling the trigger. Everything else was being out in the country with good friends and a dog that you care for and love, and beauty. I mean, this, you know, just a simple thrill of seeing beautiful things. I recall clearly two springs ago being with John on the Turkey Woods in the spring, which, by the way, is one of the most beautiful places, Spring Woods, and we saw, what was it, Jack in the Pulpit we saw, John?
Oh, right, yeah, giant one.
It was huge, giant, and we were just thrilled by that. I'd never seen anything like that, and when John got excited, I knew it must be pretty incredible.
Rhonda.
So just those kinds of things, or morel mushroom gathering, all that stuff is it adds to the tradition and the magnificence of the experience, and it all goes together, but the killing is a very small part of it, actually. But when it makes it to your table and it's a fine meal with a good wine and good friendship, it's pretty amazing.
Ron, does it frustrate you the way hunters are often portrayed in the media as being thoughtless and careless and only concerned with bagging a trophy?
Yeah, it does, because I know an awful lot of them. But like I said, I know an awful lot of grouse hunters, and most of the guys, in fact, all the guys, I've watched Mark do it. I pick up, and he's watched me do it. We find shells in the woods. We pick them up. We find bottles and plastic things. We pick them up. We put them in the bag in the car, and we take them and dispose of them. I think there are fewer of those hunters, or at least I like to think there are. But I say the guys and gals I know who hunt, when they go out there, they're careful to take good care of the land and of the game and the songbirds, and they pick up after themselves. They leave no trace.
Mark, are there a lot of younger hunters in society these days? Is this tradition of birding in danger of dying out?
Well, no. It's certainly at risk, and I think there's a variety of reasons. One is the nature of our modern society, and people are busy. Kids are more involved in very organized, regulated activities, or the computer, and the state of wild birds, and certainly in southern Ohio used to be among the best quail hunting in the country. I mean, John
absolutely
remembers that,
the bobwhite,
and there used to be a lot of grouse in further east in Ohio, and that's dramatically reduced numbers, and I think people will migrate, will go to where they can have success, where they see game, and that means deer and turkey hunting. And it's a lot of work to feed a dog, take a dog to a vet, and train a dog for a few weeks of activity in a year.
And Joanne, since you originally set out to find some recipes for wild game, whatever came of that? Did you find some recipes or places
did.
That people can try?
Well,
try this if they don't hunt.
No. You're not going to really find it if you don't hunt. I mean, you can order, from D'Artagnan online, you can order Scottish pheasant and you can order partridge and things like that. But and those, I think some of them are farm raised. I'm not exactly sure where they are getting those. But to try, the things that we're talking about here, to try rough grouse, which I did at Mark's house. It was wonderful.
Did you? Oh,
yes,
great.
They cooked, we had grouse, we had woodcock, and we had doves, right?
And quail and pheasant.
And quail and pheasant, yes.
Wow,
so we tried,
you got a potpourri of
all different kinds of birds. So that was great. That was a lot of fun.
Joanne, Mark, Ron, and John, thank you for talking with us this afternoon. Joanne Drilling from Cincinnati Magazine and members of the local chapter of the Ruffed Grouse Society, Mark Jones, outdoors writer and author Ron Ellis, and wildlife artist John Ruthven. To read Joanne's article, Birdmen, pick up a copy of the January Cincinnati Magazine or visit the magazine's website. You can find a link at wvxu.org. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at wvxu.org. The producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. The technical director was Bruce Ellis. I'm Mark Haney.